Thank you. I am Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous since January the 1st of 1973, for which I'm very grateful. We do that in Texas. They tell me in Texas, if you don't have a sobriety date, if you don't give a sobriety date, you're not likely to have one. So I try to get one. Not only am an alcoholic, I am many things. Most of them are things that other people don't want to be, like I'm a lawyer. I'm the adult spouse of an Almond. And it's the most severe form. They took my problem to a public meeting and discussed it there. Explained to my wife that I had blackouts and didn't remember a damn thing, and just gave her total freedom to make up all these lies about things I was doing. And we stayed away. I really am proud to be a part of sort of a cultural exchange here. Down in my part of the country, we've not always been thought of as being very couth or we're kind of backward, actually, what it amounts to. And we've appreciated the people from other parts of the country bringing culture to us from time to time. We have a town south of Dallas that's a really good example. It's named Waxahachie. Waxahachie means buffalo dung in Indian. We have interesting names for our towns, descriptive, I might say. And Waxahachie didn't have much culture, and it so happened that some of our eastern neighbors decided that they would travel to Texas and bring an opera. And they didn't have enough money to bring all the players and all the parts, so they took the leads, and they'd go from community to community, and they would take the local townspeople and train them in the parts of the opera, the non-singing roles. And it so happened that a company of this type came to Waxahachie. And they got the local gymnasium, and they practiced, and they got the local people involved, and they got ready, and they were going to have the big show. And one of the major non-speaking roles was the heroine. And the heroine, she was a local girl. She didn't have to sing. And they gave her one of those hats, you know, with the horns on it and the big hubcaps. And she was to die in the final act, tragically. The tenor is always the lead role, and the tenor was to kill her with a knife. And on the occasion in question, they came to the last scene of the last act, and the tenor pulled out his rubber knife and stabbed her with the rubber knife. And then he delivered his lines, which were, as he held her in his arms, "Oh, my love, too late, my love, what have I done, my love?" Now, in this town, there was an alcoholic. And he attended this performance, and he saw this lady who he knew well, lying prostrate in the arms of the tenor. And he stood up in the back of the room, and he said, "I'll tell you what you've done. You've killed the only whore in Waxahachie." Interfere with your social life. It's marvelous to be here, to be in the middle of the solution, to be a part of a solution which is unprecedented. I I'm always a little awed when I see this many people get together who are following the precepts and principles that were laid down by Dr. Bob and Bill in those early AAs, and to recognize what that can do for us in our life. A wise man once said that to win at life, to be a success at life, did not depend upon being dealt good cards, but playing poor hands well. And seemed to me like when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been dealt a poor hand. I did not view this as any kind of an opportunity. This was a, at most, very painful, absolutely the last house on the block type of a solution that I had. I didn't like you people. I really didn't. It was hokey as hell. You know, you go to meetings and grown people. Some guy stands up and says, "My name's Jerry," and everybody says, "Jerry." Oh, high school Harry, you talk about that. My gosh, I expected him to come up and teach me the grip any time, you know. They had disgusting habits of hugging and patting each other at random, you know. I didn't feel like hugging and patting. I just, you know, it was not much fun for me. I was at the end of the rope. I had gone as far as I could go. And I had no solutions. And isn't it interesting, that's exactly where I needed to be. I know today that that is a remarkable place to be. To be at the end of the road and to know that your solutions don't work. My old ideas and my disease had taken me as far as I could go that day. I suppose if there hadn't been an AA, or if I hadn't found at that time, I would have had another opportunity, maybe. I don't know. But it didn't happen that way. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous very reluctantly, very angry, very much convinced that there was only perhaps one major, well, maybe two, or was it three problems in my life. One was drinking. I recognized I might have some kind of a problem with alcohol. The other was my Al-Anon wife, and I knew I had a problem there. I didn't like much about life at all. And I walked in and I saw the kind of solution that you had to offer, and it was pathetic. It's pathetic. I knew it wasn't going to work, and if there'd been anything else to try, I wouldn't have tried it at all. But I didn't really realize what was happening. I didn't really realize that I was about to embark upon something called a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience. Those had spooky sounds to me, you know, kind of like haints and that sort of thing. I hadn't had much experience with spiritual awakenings or spiritual experiences, and I didn't much think they would work. I was a cynic, and I didn't much believe. I looked very closely at damn near everything, and I didn't think this would work, and I was not really doing much in the program until I began to observe some people in the program. If you're new in the program of AA, and I know many of you are because you're very young, and if you're new, look around you, and they'll tell you to look for the winners, to follow the winners. They'll be the last people in the world you're really attracted to in the beginning. They won't understand you. And they won't tolerate your nonsense very much, maybe. But if you watch them in the way they live and the way they move, you will be attracted to what they have. And if you follow that feeling, you will have stumbled upon probably the greatest principle of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the principle of experience. What man has done, man can do. If the person you like and admire has achieved some peace in his life and some success and some good, then that's available for you also. I encountered that experience early in my life. I was raised out in West Texas, up in the panhandle of Texas, on 10 miles north of a town of 1,500 people, Bolivina, Texas. We didn't have electricity, and we didn't have running water in houses and things like that in the beginning. And every once a week, we got to go to town. And when I went to town, I saw the town kids had bicycles. And I decided that I wanted a bicycle. And my dad told my dad about that, and he decided he'd buy me one. So we ordered one from the Sears and Roebuck catalog. And we came, and he put it together and gave it to me. And I got on the bicycle, only to find that it was harder to ride a bicycle than I had thought it would be. I fell over and busted my can. My mother got out there, and she would trot along beside me and hold the bicycle up. And she would turn the bicycle loose, and I would fall over and bust my can again. I did that for about 2 days. And I come upon a great truth. I had been sold a defective bicycle. That's true. The bicycle I had acquired could not be ridden. And I explained that to my parents, that they bought me a defective bicycle. We're going to send the damn thing back. And my mother looked at me. She was a plucky little Irishman. And she said, "Jerry Jones, there's not anything wrong with that bicycle. That's a fine bicycle." She said, I've only ridden a bicycle maybe one time in my life, but I could ride that bicycle." And I said, "Well, I didn't say that." I said, "You cannot." So the next day, she got out there, and she got on that bicycle and fell over and busted her can. I knew that was going to happen. I felt a little sad about it, but I was always smarter than she was, and so she swung up on it again, and by gosh, do you know, she rode that thing about 25 or maybe 30 feet down the road. It kind of tipped over, and she got off of it and laid it on the ground and said, "It's all yours." You know, in an hour, I was riding that bicycle. And that's what we've got in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you pick the right people to sponsor you, to listen to walk you through the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, what's available there for them is available for you. You don't have any idea. You don't have any idea what you can be or become, because we haven't tried to be or become what we can be by applying the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have to apply those principles because it's necessary for us to learn to live life in a way that doesn't give us so much pressure and pain and disappointment. Because pressure and pain and disappointment lead us to become uncomfortable. And we know, as alcoholics, way down deep, that we have a solution for that. We know that a drink would make it better. And if we don't find a way to live comfortably and easily, we will drink again. So we're motivated by absolute necessity to begin to look at our lives. I didn't think I had a disease when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I had some kind of lack of willpower, of some form of moral leprosy or something like that. I couldn't understand what was wrong with me. And it's difficult to explain what alcoholism is to people. One of the best examples came to me in a meeting of AA one night when I remembered the story about my dog, Patches. I had a bulldog. His name was Patches. Hell of a dog. I mean, he was big old English bull, and mostly English bull, and he was tough. He was good with kids. He just had it all put together. Everybody loved him. He had success in his life. A week or so before this story I'm about to tell you, he'd gone up in the field and found a big old badger. Weighed a pound more than he did. I know, because after fighting him all morning, he finally got him killed and we were able to wait. Every day for a week, Patches would go up there in the field and pick up that old badger and just shake hell out of him, just let him know his boss. He had strong character. This day, another animal came in our yard. He was a big old boar hog. Big devil. 600, 700 pounds. Patches made a decision to go get hold of the boar hog. Didn't have any problems. Didn't have a problem in his life. He was full, had been fed well, petted, played with. Everything was wonderful. But he decided, for some reason we didn't know, to go get hold of that hog. And he went out and got hold of the hog. Created a real problem in our yard when he did that. Hog began to squeal. Dog was barking. My dad got out there right away, and he was kicking hogs and dogs and cussing. I became concerned about my dog, and I got out there trying to take care of my dog. And
My dad was not real careful about who he was cussing and kicking at that time, and my mother became very concerned that her little boy was out there, and so she got out there, and everybody was out there, and we all knew the solution to the problem. Patches turned loose with that damn hog. He hooked on there. You know, bulldogs don't turn loose easily, and finally he came off. And as he came off, an old boar hog swung around and cut his throat. And we caught him. Caught Patches, and we slowed him down, and we cooled him off, and we bathed his neck, and we petted him, and we turned him loose. And he went right back and got hold of that boar hog again. Same problem. Same problem. Hog squealing, dog barking, dad kicking and cussing. Me out there trying to save my dog, mom out there trying to save me. Everybody knew the solution. Hog knew it. We knew it. Everybody turned loose the damn hog patches. Well, he came off one more time. This time we caught him again. And we recognized that Patches' emotional state was out of whack. His emotions were on top of his intellect, or something was happening to him. And so this time we committed him. We tied him to the water hydrant. And we let him think about his life. And to recognize, he never had a good day catching hogs. Not one. In the family enjoyed his hog catching at all. No one thought it was cute or funny or heroic or anything else. It's just a bad deal. Got you hurt. And we ran the boar hog off to remove temptation from him. And he lay there, and I petted him and nurtured him and cared for him. And you could see he was getting better. His little old stub of a tail would wag. And after 2 hours, it was obvious he would recover, and we turned him loose. He had to go 2 miles to find the hog the next time. Is that alcoholism? Not only is that alcoholism, we were the first chapter of Hogganon in West Texas. See, the old dog had, it looked like his problem was catching hold of hogs. But that wasn't a problem at all. It was something behind the catching hold of the hogs that caused the problem. What made him go the first time? What sent him back again and again? What made him switch from hogs to cattle trucks a couple of weeks later when he got run over? That was my story too, you see. It seemed to me like if I just stopped drinking, everybody told me, Jerry, if you just didn't drink, you would be a better father, lawyer, husband. They had a long list of things I'd be better at if I didn't drink. It seemed that way to me, finally. And I didn't recognize that I had to do some studying in my life. I had to go to work on my life as the only person in the world who knew what was going on in my head. The only person who could keep up with what was going on in my head. The only person who could apply the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. I was the one that had to take the action that began to let me find the old ideas that I had that sent me back again and again and again to this terrible condition that we called alcoholism and the drug alcohol. And I didn't have an idea what those were. They seemed like good ideas, largely. Certainly they weren't anything that you would be ashamed of, for the most part. In looking at my life after I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I look back on what my values were. You know, the book says that one of the things it says in there, that the great fact for us is just this and nothing less, that we've had this spiritual awakening, which has revolutionized our ideas about God, our universe, and our fellow man. A change of attitude about our values in our life. The psyche, that part of you which is in your mind, which sees you in relation to the rest of the world. That has to be changed. And I didn't know there was anything wrong with mine. I have grown up as a little old kid out there in a community where everybody liked me. My folks were loving and kind people. They were hardworking. My dad was tough. He was a strict disciplinarian, but my gosh, he gave me a square shake. The town, they didn't load me up with a lot of pressures that a lot of places do. You know, my town was the kind of place, if you were playing on the baseball team and they had a home run, all week long, they'd buy you moss. If you happen to be the guy that struck out in the bottom of the ninth, you know what they'd do that week? Buy you moss. It was damn near impossible for me to be an alcoholic. There wasn't any booze for hundreds of miles. But when I got it, it did something for me. And why did it do something for me? Looking back on my life, I could see that I had some ideas. And those ideas loaded me up pretty good. First idea, I want to be a man. I defined what a man is. And man to me was sort of a cross between Robert Redford and John Wayne. Cut myself no slack. Knew all my life I was going to be one of those when I grew up. That's what my dad was. He's a man. They told me I was going to grow up and be a man one day. They told me little men don't cry. And I bought all that stuff. Seemed like a very logical thing for me to want to be. And I got off into being a man. And I watched my dad. Dad one time was working on a plow. I remember this, and he was chiseling the head off of a bolt with a big hammer and a chisel, and he was just beating the bejeebies out of it. And he missed it just a little bit. The chisel flew out of his hand, and he skinned his knuckles real good with that hammer. Blood went everywhere. He stood up and cussed a little bit. It was okay to cuss to be a man. I knew that. I practiced that when they weren't around. And he slung blood for a little bit, and he walked back over there and picked up that chisel and got that hammer again. And just before he started hitting it, I said, "Daddy, did that hurt?" He looked at me with those hard eyes of his, and he said, "Hell no." And he went right back to work. Well, 2 or 3 days later, I was playing like I was a man, and I had me a chisel and a hammer. And I whacked her a couple times, and guess what? Hit my hand. Not very bad, but you know what? Hurt like hell. Hurt like hell, and I cried. Not only did it hurt and I cried, but I was afraid to do it anymore. And so I plumped being a man on 3 points right there in one short experience. And that was the story for me. I got started off and I felt like I was supposed to be something I wasn't and couldn't be. I decided over and over, I just won't hurt anymore. And I kept being pushed into places by my own needs to be important, to be accepted, to get attention of people, to avoid rejection, to avoid being ignored, all those things. I got pushed out there just to do things that I didn't like to do. I remember when I went out for football. I was in 8th grade. I was tall and skinny, about the same height that I am now. Somebody thought I was going to be a big man someday. In 8th grade, the coach came by and said, "We're going to let you boys, some of you big boys, go out for football in the spring with the high school team." Well, that sounded good to me. I didn't know anything about football, but it sounded good to me. So I went out there, and they gave me one of them outfits you put on, you know, to keep you from getting hurt. I know what they're for. And I watched real close. They put all that contraption on me, and I got out there, and it's, you know, it was quite an experience for me. First thing you know, they begin to tackle and block, and that damn equipment of mine wasn't working because I was getting the bejeebies knocked out of me. Skin was coming off in large handfuls, and I made a decision before I went back to the gym that afternoon that I had all this football I wanted. I caught up a lifetime supply of football in one afternoon. And I had a little trouble getting this gear off of me, and a couple of my classmates got theirs off first, and they slammed it over in the corner and stomped out of there and told the coach they ain't going to play. And the coach and some of the other guys, those high school guys standing around there, and they began to talk about men. And they talked about yellow streaks down the guys' backs. And they looked over at me and they said, "Jones, how'd you like football?" I said, "I've been wanting to play football all my life." So I got into football, you see, and I never did like it real good, but I never could find a place to quit. Finally, it outgrew me, thank God. I busted up everything, and I just kept going back. And you see, there was a great internal conflict in me. I needed to be a man, but I didn't really feel like I was. I needed to be a winner. God, I wanted to be a winner. But I felt like a loser. I wanted to be successful, but I didn't feel like I ever had enough. And I kept pushing myself. I got after things called more, better, and different. No matter what I had, I wanted a little more of it, a little better quality of it, or a little different. And that just went across everything I got hold of. Cars, women, houses, whatever it happened to be. You know, I just wanted a little more, better, or different. And I could never find anything that made me very happy. And whatever I had, I didn't feel like I deserved. Now, I don't mean I felt that way every day, but that was kind of a recurring feeling for me. Now, what happened to me is one day, I went to college. And I ran across a bunch of guys in a thing called a fraternity. And they invited me to a party, and I wanted to go because I wanted to be accepted. And they were upperclassmen, and they took me out there, and they showed me a commodity called beer. Nasty stuff, I'll tell you. Comes out your nose and everything. And I just, it's kind of like football. I said, Jones, how you like beer? And I said, I like this beer. And I made myself drink that stuff for a little bit, but I got to where I liked it real good. It made me what? I didn't care. Feel like a man. Hey, man, I don't care whether the school keeps or not. I was a damn fool. You know, these guys were on the GI Bill. They gave them their books, and they'd sell their books the next day if they gave them to them and go on a party. I went in and bought my damn books and sold them the next day so I'd go on a party. But I was off and running. I liked the people that drank. I liked where we drank. I liked what we drank. I liked the people who drank with us. Oh, man, I liked it. It let me not care about a lot of things. I liked the ease and comfort of those drinks. And I don't know whether I liked that more than other people, but I know that in the very beginning, two or three of the guys that came to school with me and were my roommates at the time told me that they didn't think that they wanted to do what I was doing. They didn't think they wanted to get off in that beer drinking, hell raising bunch. And I watched them walk out of my life, and as they walked out, I wondered, why in the world wouldn't they want to do this? Why in the world? Well, God, this is so much better than anything we've ever had before. Why wouldn't you want to do this? And I got that deep obsession then, you see. And over time, because I never intended to give that up, and before I got into a lot of trouble, we got to announce it here. It's license number HMK330 and JTK823 and HPP294. Cars are blocking the exit. The kitchen staff cannot leave. They are armed with cleavers and are coming into the office. If you have one of those cars, you can let them out. That was in HMK330, JTK823, and HPP294. I never did intend to give that up. I just thought that was my success for life. And the pressures that I had from these old ideas, the wanting to be a success, the wanting to be a winner, the wanting to be a man, all of those things that I was carrying around with me, each one of them seemed perfectly logical. Each one of them was admired by the people that I was associated with. And it seemed like good ideas, but they created enormous pressures in me, and alcohol repeated them. Gave me a little vacation from those pressures. And I commenced to use it, and I never intended to give it up. And I increased its usage on a steady basis for the next 10 or 15 years of my life. It caused trouble. It caused problems in my family. My wife, I finally had to send her to a psychiatrist because she had some kind of goofy reaction to the way I drank. Just bizarre. And the psychiatrist agreed with me. She had a real strong reaction to my drinking, but before long they were talking to me about the way I drank. I was always solving the peripheral problems, you know. I could just keep finding excuses. And I could do things that were just bizarre. I remember one time we were talking about my smoking year. I gave up smoking a long time back. And what I don't know that you're going to think I deserve a lot of credit for that. Let me tell you this story. We had a little couple experiences in my house, you know, little things. Well, in bed mainly. I smoked in bed, and at times there were little holes burned in the covers and blankets. Not anything to get excited about. Certainly not anything to react the way my damn wife reacted to. And that's why you have bed covers, isn't it? You cover those damn things up when it's, you know, I mean, yeah. But this one morning I woke up, a night I guess it was, and my side of the bed was blazing pretty good. I had been up apparently, and I had been somewhere taking care of some kind of business, and came back, and I was an automatic smoker. I automatically lit a cigarette. I apparently sat down on the edge of the bed and fired up, and then I got very tired, and I laid back and I rested a little bit, and I dozed off. That's all a simple little thing like that. And that's a hard thing to explain. If it ever happens to you, the best explanation that I've ever heard is just tell them you think the damn thing was on fire when you got in it. I got up the next morning, and I don't know where I had to go or what I had to do, but I had to get the hell out of there pretty quick, and so I left, and I told my wife, buy any kind of bed you want, and I was gone. You know, when I got home, she had written me a letter. I don't know why she wrote me a letter. I was going to come home anyway, and she wrote me this letter. She didn't mail it. It was just sitting there on the table where I'd see it. It said, Dear Jerry, I've been talking to you about your drinking and smoking. It's now reached the point where I cannot comfortably go to bed in my own home without worrying about my own health and the health and safety of our children. You simply must do something about the smoking and drinking. And I did. I quit smoking. Never thought about quitting drinking. Gave it no thought at all. I just saw peripheral problems, and I kept rationalizing and justifying and looking the other way. And that was true of most of my old ideas. I rationalize and justify, express, and it's always somebody else's fault. It's not mine. If you understood the kind of problem I had, and I went through all of that. And the thing that finally caught my attention, the thing that finally got me aware of what was going on in my life was my wife and alcohol. I, by this time, have progressed. I was driving hard. I had a lot of success in my life. I had achieved positions in my law firm that I never dreamed I'd achieve. I was making more money than I'd ever thought I would make. And all the time, my life was going to hell right there in a handbasket, you know. And it finally got, I wasn't out in the bars either. I needed to protect that position. I needed to protect that success. So, yeah, I got drunk in bars. Yeah, I got picked up by the cops. Yeah, I had trouble, but after I got caught, I would quit going to that place or quit doing those things. And slowly and surely, I retreated into my den. I lived in my damn den, and I went out to work, and I stayed at work as long as I had to be there or as long as I could without a drink. And then I would go back to the den. And that was my life. I brought my disease right home with me so my whole family could enjoy it. And I was in deep denial about this being any kind of a problem. But my life was set up. Now, when I found out that my wife had gone to Al-Anon, I didn't know what it was. I was asking my little girl one night where Billy was. That's my wife. And she said, Daddy, she's gone to a meeting. And I said, what kind of a meeting? And she said, I don't know, Daddy, a family meeting. Well, we had been having some serious discussions about our family, and it didn't seem proper to me that she would go to some kind of a damn meeting without me being along to represent my interests. And so when she came home, I began to cross-examine her. I loved cross-examining my wife. I just loved her. And she's good at ducking. Oh, she's good at ducking. You know, you can ask her a question, where you been? Out. What have you been doing out? Well, I've been seeing some friends. Who are they? You wouldn't know them. What have you been doing with them? Oh, sharing our experience, strength, and hope. Well, after about an hour of this stuff, you know, I run it down to what's the name of this meeting you've been going to? Al-Anon. I couldn't imagine why she would want to go to some kind of aluminum product. So I asked a couple more questions, and it turned out it had something to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I made the association very quickly here. I found out that this was a public meeting. Do you know that anybody can go to an Al-Anon meeting? They don't check on a damn thing. They just, anybody who wants to come can come. And you know how judges are and politicians and all those people. Hell, they're always looking for meetings to go to and politic to, and they know all the lawyers in town. And it was obvious to me, here I was, a big-time lawyer, and my wife was going to a public meeting about my most secret problem. I was being tried and convicted of alcoholism without any hearing whatsoever. Nobody was telling my side of the story. And I explained to her, somebody is going to see you there. A judge's wife, one of my partners, their wives, their families, clients, witnesses, jurors. There are thousands of people in the city of Dallas. If any one of them sees you there, it will mean economic disaster and ruin for me and my family. Do you understand how that will happen? The word will get back to my partners. You know we've had a couple of alcoholic partners for years. We have exercised our full quota for alcoholic lawyers. They don't want any more. The clients, the lawyers, they'll kick me out. The clients won't go with me. And when I get out of that job and that position, the money stops. When the money stops, the house goes. The cars go. The groceries go. We're not talking about college education now for our children. We're talking about abject poverty and hunger. The responsibility is all yours, Billy. What are you going to do about it? She said, I need to go. She said, I have a problem. And I said, what is your problem? And she said, my problem is the way you drink. And I said, that sounds like my problem to me. Well, I couldn't run her off. I asked her nicely. I begged her some. I threatened to kill her if she ever went back again. She kept going. If they ever get a hold on you, man, I'll tell you what, they got you. I'll tell you for sure. Anyway, she kept going, and I couldn't leave her alone. Not a night passed that I wasn't after her about that album. She was always leaving literature around, and, you know, just drove me crazy. And one night, I had to get her out of there, you see, and I was picking a fight with her. I pick fights. I don't just say we're going to have a fight. I ease into my fights. I try to establish and get all the concessions I can before they know they're in a fight. And I would start off with something like this. And I said, do you think I'm an alcoholic? She said, I don't know whether you are or not. I said, what do you mean you don't know whether I am? You call me an alcoholic thousands of times. And she said, yes, but I was wrong. You can't hardly start a fight with a person exactly like this. She said, it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what anybody thinks. You are the only person in the world that can do anything about your alcoholism. And if you don't know you have it, you'll never do anything about it. You've got to decide for yourself. Are you an alcoholic or are you not? Now, right at this point, I made a very basic tactical error. No good lawyer ever makes this mistake. But I was upset and off my feet, and I said, well, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it? They got an answer. She said, you should try some controlled drinking. I said, what do you mean, controlled drinking? She said, you should drink 2 drinks a day, every day, for 6 months, no more, no less. If you can do that, you're not an alcoholic, you tell me. I said, you've been trying to get me to quit drinking for years. Is it my understanding that you want me to drink another 6 months? She said, I do. I knew I was in the middle of something that I did not understand. So I went and sat down in my green chair and got me a drink and began to give this thing a good think. I was drinking a little more than I intended to drink then. I came home from work and drank about half a quart of gin before dinner. And then I had two or three bites of mashed potatoes and switched to brandy, and I drank a half a fifth of brandy. I didn't know anybody else that drank that way, but I thought I was drinking what I wanted to drink. It was my life. It was my bottle. Who the hell was, who could fuss at me, you know? And so I sat there that night, and I thought, you know, I better get that woman out of Alma. I was serious about this. I didn't want anybody to know I had this kind of problem. I really did. I had some partners. They talked pretty shabby about down in my place of business, about being alcoholics. So I didn't tell her this, but I decided I'll take that damn test. Now, let me tell you about this. First, I had to change the test just a little bit. Well, you don't understand. Two drinks didn't do me any good. And I didn't like the drink if it didn't do me any good. I decided I'd drink three drinks. I had a big glass, and I'd have two big martinis before dinner. I would eat, and then I would have a big brandy. And nobody could fuss at me for drinking that way. And they could not, and they would not have. But I ran across a problem. I found out that I didn't have the hold of the hog, the hog had hold of me. I would have one drink. I would get about midway through the second drink, and then it would happen. A thought would come in from way out of the left field. It was always about the same kind of thought. It would say something like, "What are you doing? What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Who supports this damn family and pays for all this house and all them cars and all that stuff? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you after it with me? And the answer was hell no. Hell no, I'm not. And I'd go over and drink the bottle. Another thing would happen. I'd walk to the bar, start to mix the first of those three drinks, and think, you know, I've had a bad day. I just don't feel like screwing the damn test tonight. And I wouldn't. And when I didn't feel like screwing the test tonight, I drank the bottle. Then I had another real cute trick. I could forget the test. I could just flat forget it for a couple of weeks at a time. And when I'd wake up one morning really hungover and think, my God, why'd I do that? What's wrong with me? It's important to get that woman out of with those loonies, get her away from them. You've got to do something about your life. You've got to get this thing settled down. You've got to get her out of there. And I could not understand why I couldn't do that. It was totally illogical for a grown man to decide he was going to only have three drinks and then not do it. It wasn't the rest of my life. It was only 6 months. I gave it a fair chance. I gave the test a good run. I ran it a year and a half. Had some good days in the middle of that time, I suppose. But over the long haul, I came to know a great basic fact. I came to get in touch with reality. One of the things our book says that we're going to find the great reality deep inside ourselves. We're going to find out what's really going on in our lives. And I had to find out that I didn't have alcohol. Alcohol had me. And at the end of that year and a half, there wasn't a doubt in my mind. I was gone. I couldn't understand what was happening to me. I couldn't talk to anybody about this. Oh, I had lots of chances, I suppose, to talk to people, but I was so secretive about this, and I was so intent upon doing this thing my way, and I just couldn't understand what was happening to me. All I could do at the end of that time was to think about drinking, wishing I had a drink, wishing I hadn't had a drink, trying to forget the damn test, remembering the test. And all this time, my wife is getting better. That's a remarkable thing about this damned Al-Anon program. Right in the midst of while I'm going right straight down, she's coming right straight up. And she's doing the damnedest things, things that kind of remind me about my test pretty often. Her sponsor told her that she should start every day. The moment she opened her eyes, she should say out loud, "This is the day the Lord has made. I shall rejoice and be glad in it." Now, if you've never had a one-quart hangover with one eye stuck shut, one of your arms feels like it's dead because you've been sleeping on it wrong all night long, and awake and have somebody say, this is the day the Lord has made. I'm going to rejoice and be glad in it. You have not truly understood what Al-Anon is. I knew damn well I wasn't going to be rejoicing any that day. And I told my wife on January the 1st, I had had a bad New Year's Eve. I really did need to bring it in with, some grace and dignity. I wish I could stand here and tell you that I really, really tore it up on New Year's Eve, 1972. I'd like to tell you that. I got to tell you, I went out like a wimp. I was going to last till the New Year came in and Harriet the governor. I passed out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I woke up about 10 o'clock at night, looked out the window, and there, dark as hell out there, and my wife's sitting over there in her robe, and I said, shouldn't we be getting dressed to go out? She said, oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is? And I looked, and it's 10 o'clock. I'd blown it again. And I was sick of me. I was sick of what I was and what I'd become. And I didn't have anybody to blame for that. That was me. It was my doing. I was responsible. And I got up and had another drink and went to bed. And the next morning I got up to the sorriest looking world I've ever seen in my life. It's just gray. There was no hope there. There was only one thing I knew I might try, and that was to not drink. And so I made a big step that morning. I said to my wife, I'm going to try to quit drinking. And she said, would you like me to call Alcoholics Anonymous and get somebody over here to help you? And I said, hell no. I got myself in this deal, and by God, if anybody gets me out of it, it'll be me. And she happened to have a copy of the big book and the little 24-hour day book, and she said, you may find these helpful. I graciously received them and threw them back at her against the wall and said, now, lady, I'm telling you, keep the kids, the dogs, them damn AAs and all that literature crap out of my way. I don't know whether I can do this or not, but it ain't going to be easy. And she said, you got it. And I had it. And it had me. And I began to come apart. I walked the streets and felt I'd been alone a long time, but I really began to feel lonely now. I watched people walking around doing their thing, happy with their kids, looking forward to a new year, and I saw no hope for me. All I could think about was wanting a drink. Wondered what was wrong with me. Why did I have this terrible drive to have a drink, to get away from it? Over and over, I just thought about it all the time. At the end of the second day, I began to think, I'm not going to make this damn thing. I better sneak in there and get hold of some of that damn literature and see what it said. And I did. I went in there, and I didn't have time for it. I was afraid she'd find me in there reading that damn stuff. But I found that little 24-hour day book, and I quick opened it up, and I saw it had a date on every page. With my keen alcoholic mind, I went to January 2nd. I'm going to read what they say to do. What do you suppose they told me to do? They said, give your drinking problem to God. Ain't that some kind of damn joke? How are you going to give it to somebody you can't find? I've been looking for this thing all my life. I've gone up to the front. I've been dedicated, rededicated. I've lied about whether I've been saved or not. They asked me, and I'm standing up there at the front. People are crying on my neck and telling me how proud they are of me. They say, don't you feel different? I say, oh, yeah. Yeah, I really do. I did. I felt more disappointed than I'd ever felt in my life because nothing ever happened to me. I want some proof. I ain't going to buy into this hokey stuff unless somebody gives me some proof that this thing really works. I want to hear a voice. I want that damn bouquet to talk to me for a little bit or something. But I wasn't getting that kind of proof, and I never did get it, and I got to looking at those people real close, and they looked like hypocrites to me. I saw what they were doing. I saw what they were doing out of church. So I just became one of them. I just hypocrite right along with them. But I never found anything and never got any solutions in my life. And for me to read this stuff, my God, it was pathetic. And I wouldn't have done this if I'd had anything else to do. I tossed that little book out in the middle of the table, and I said, God, if you're there, I'm going to give you this drinking problem. And if you take it, I may do some more business with you. The next day I knew I was going to have some help. I needed some help with skin on it. I needed some people. And I began to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you heard how I accepted it when I got there. I wanted to go to a little home group at first, a little quiet home group called the Town and Country Group. That sounded like my kind of place. They had eons of sobriety. The guys, their baby had a year and a half, and the next guy had five, and then they got to 10 or 15 years, and they didn't have, but I got 10 of them. And they had one little meeting a week, and I didn't think they had much of a drinking problem. You can't stay sober 10 years the way I felt and have, if you got much of a drinking problem. And then into that group came an old kid from a treatment center. He had less than 6 months. His name was David. And he had literature sticking out of every damn pocket. He was just talking about the disease and step one and step two and step four and it and all this stuff, that I just kind of in a whirl with him, And after the meeting was over, I got outside with him. I said, "What do you think about this AA thing?" He said, "You talking about what we just been in there?" He said, "That's fine for a bunch of old times like that, I guess." I said, "Anything will be good for me and you." He said, "We're going to get drunk if we do that. We're going to have to get in the middle of this thing, because see, we're going to have to change the way we think. We're going to have a spiritual awakening. We're going to have to do this thing." And I said, "Where are we going to go to do it?" And I followed David into the mainstream of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I gave her a good shot. I really gave it a good shot. It wasn't very long until it was attraction rather than anything else that drove me. I liked what was happening there. I liked the way the people were reacting. I began to have some wonderful experiences in my life. I came to understand a thing called self-centeredness. When I got there, I thought my only problem was drinking. But listening to you in those meetings, I began to understand what they meant by things like unmanageable, self-centered, things like that. One night I was sitting in a meeting like that, and they were talking about that, and I remembered my fishbowl. I got tired of watching television while I was doing my drinking. So I bought me an aquarium. It was my size of aquarium. I put it between my chair and the wall so nobody would mess with it. And I put the kind of gravel I wanted it in the bottom, and I put the kind of plants I wanted in it, lacy, pretty plants. And I put the kind of fish I wanted in there, pretty slow-swimming fish. It had a light on it. I could make it daylight or I could make it dark. I fed my fish, if they were to be fed. Sometimes it was a land of plenty, and sometimes there was a famine upon the land. And as I sat in a meeting that night, I remembered my fish bowl, and I remembered that there was always one damn fish who simply would not do what I wanted him to do. He was always a fish. Generally, he was after the prettiest fish in the bowl. I like to watch him glide up and nibble a little food, at the top. Like pretty slow-swimming fish. And I could dream and think about those wild things I was going to do next time and, fantasize. And fast-swimming fish just are not conducive to that. And he'd go up and nip the tail of a fish, And as he nipped the tail, a fish began to swim faster, and he'd chase it. The first thing one of them's chasing the other, and they begin to pass other fish, and the other fish gets going too. First thing the whole damn bowl just going back and forth. Just drove me crazy. If I wanted fast-swimming fish, I'd have bought fast-swimming fish. And I'd reach over there, and I'd whop the side of that fish, and I'd move it like that. Give them a clap of thunder. Let them know there's a power greater than they are. There's some fish you didn't learn after 3 times. Then I had a little dip net. After After the third time, I just reach down there and catch the bad fish, pull him out of the water, hold him on my lap. Have a drink. Think about those people out there I'd like to put my fish net on. When they got real still, I would put them back. Sometimes they float. If they float, you might as well give up on them. Once again, I practiced the mystical rule of three, and I gave them three chances. You'd know after three claps of thunder and three hands-on experience from the deity, they would learn, wouldn't you? Well, I got to tell you, there are such unfortunates, they seem to have been born there. The last time, the fourth time, after the dip nets, I pulled them out and went with them to the commode and flushed them. See, I never told a soul about that. That was a game I played entirely on my own. My son heard me tell that story one time, and he said, "My God, I wonder where all those fish went." And I thought my life was manageable. You know, it's difficult to argue that your life is manageable when you can't run a fish boat. It's difficult to say you're not self-centered when you take personally what fish do. So I began to find self-centeredness a little ways first and in big ways later on. I did the inventories and the fifth steps, and I learned that the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous work. I made amends. I mailed a copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous to that little Irish mother of mine, and let her read it to my dad so they could understand what their kid was trying to do. I got to straighten out that deal with my mom and dad before they died. I buried both of them. See, life doesn't go on undisturbed after you find it's broken. You're going to have death, and you're going to have disappointments, and you're going to lose jobs. Lots of things are going to happen to you that you don't like. But your job from this point forward in this program is to recognize that you are responsible for your inner state. You don't have to be hurting and sick all the time. You don't have to get repeatedly fired from the job one after another. You don't have to go through a whole string of relationships always looking for that wonderful one that's just going to fix everything. What you've got to do is learn from your own experience. You've got to get down to the cases and recognize it's your life and you're responsible for it. And that's what I was lucky enough to have a sponsor and lucky enough to find people who let me do that, who helped me do that, who helped me see the way to go. And my life began to turn around. Remarkable things happened in my life. I began to see the world in a brand new way. I got new values. The feeling of uselessness that I used to have, I had no idea why I was on this ball of mud we call Earth. I couldn't imagine what the purpose of the whole damn thing was. It didn't make any sense to me. But I'll tell you what. After I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous just a little while, I came to know that I had a particular gift to give. I have a unique ability to talk to another alcoholic and to share with him the road to recovery. Let him look at my life, let him know me, warts and all. Let him understand that the most important thing that's happened in my life is to know that I am who I am. I'm fearful at times. I am weak at times. Other times I do things that I don't know how I did them. I buried my mother. I watched my father die in my arms. Never once in those occasions did I ever think about taking a drink. Those were important people in my life. All sorts of things have come my way, and I've had the strength to do it. And you see, I have this ability to reach another alcoholic. I don't ever have to wonder what my purpose in life is again. I can do something that you can't go to school to learn how to do. I can touch the life of another person by telling them of my experience, by describing accurately what happened to me with this disease and telling them what happened and how to go about it themselves. And that's a great gift. There are many doctors, clergymen, who would give a lot for that. I've been given tools that have allowed me to live a life that's different and better than anything I ever thought about. You know, Freud one time said that the goal of all psychoanalysis is to return man to that unhappy state called normalcy. Ain't that a hell of a deal you've been paying $100 an hour for? We got a better deal than that. We got a better deal than that. We got a way that works. And the secret is to get out of your own life. Did you ever set out to have just to treat yourself real good one day? I've never done that, but I didn't wind up in a deep depression by the end of the day. I just got to, the time I feel best? It's when that damn drunk is calling me at 2 o'clock in the morning. I wind up, you know, I got someplace to be the next morning. I ain't got time to mess with him. I told him not to get drunk. I explain how to work the damn program, and I go and I talk to the silly fool one more time. And as I walk out of that place, no matter what time it is, I always know I have been in the right place doing the right thing, and I feel good. Happiness is the byproduct of right living. Dr. Bob said our whole program boils down to two words, love and service. The steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous are designed to teach and allow you and I to have love and service, to enable us to contact a power that's in this room now that many of you feel. It's an experiential thing. It doesn't have anything to do with the words I say particularly or the memory you have, but it's an interaction that we have. It's a presence that's with us, a power that will restore us to sanity. God does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Is there any doubt in your mind that this works? Think for a minute. Just take this group of people right here tonight. Here we are in a nice community, in the public, the nicest building in town. I wonder how many crimes this group of people have committed. How many people, banks, creditors, we've stiffed in one way or another. We've done damn near everything wrong you can do wrong, haven't we? What would it be like to talk to the mayor and say, Mayor, we'd like to get a group of my friends together. They've been convicted of every felony known to man. They owe thousands of dollars to people they probably never will pay back. They've done just about everything wrong you can do. And we'd like to get together in your community for a little share. Here we are. And it's not because of our own efforts. It's because we have taken the action to enlist the aid of a power greater than ourselves. And that power, according to our book, if what we think or feel means anything at all, it is that a living creator, we can all have a living creator no matter what our race, color, or creed, if we have the honesty and willingness to look. We take the action, the power is there. We find self-centeredness, and when it's removed, by giving of ourselves to others, the power is there. We don't have to look anymore. We have our own experience of the power. We don't have to listen to what somebody else is, what's happened to them. We know in our own lives. It just says in the vision to you that miracles have occurred, and one has come to me and to my family. We among all people are among the most blessed. And it is our duty, it is our legacy to practice these principles in all our affairs, to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers, to give away what we have been given. I want to thank you for having me at this conference.